ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi there, Selena Green again with you today. A few producers out there, when it comes to the roads that you use to get your produce on and off farm, and whether we're talking grain, livestock, whatever you're growing, what do you reckon the areas that need the most investment? Is it that sort of last section of road connecting your farm to the major freight routes? Or is it the ageing bridges that you have to slow down for, navigate or avoid altogether? Maybe it's that new roundabout that's popped up with that new housing development that isn't big enough to get the truck around. Well, let me know on my talkback number today. It's 1300 160 222 or the text line 0467 922 783. Where in your local road network is the issue for you that's costing time and money and needs some major investment? Well, grain growers have released a new national report looking at what they see as the priorities in the nation's freight routes. And in a moment, you'll hear what they have to say. But I'm always keen to hear your views. That talkback number again, 1300 160 222. Or the text line 0467 922 783. Also coming up today, the debate is ongoing about the best way to manage the movement of potato and potato seeds around the country without risking the spread of potato mop top virus.
Are you better off to test and know what the status is versus not getting seed tested at all and taking the risk on planting that seed?
We'll come back to that story in this next half an hour as well. But first today, every year across South Australia, almost 450,000 trailer loads of grain are transported on our road network. Crisscrossing the map in our key grain-growing regions, it's a dense network of routes that link farms, bulk handlers and ports, but not all of them are up to the job. Industry group Grain Growers has a new report out this week. It's called Australia's Priority Grain Freight Routes, which highlights the urgent infrastructure and investments that are needed across each state and nationally. Grain Growers Chief Executive Shona Gavel joins me. Shona, welcome to the Country Hour.
Thanks so much for having me, Selena.
So this report, it breaks it down state by state. If we're looking at South Australia, there's sort of more or four real main findings for South Australia. Interesting, one of those is around the there's some significant differences in the road networks when you go from council to council. Really, that sort of last mile for access to grain farms?
That's correct, Selena. So it is, this is reported, as you mentioned, it has broken it down state by state, and what we're excited about is that we feel it really highlights the interconnectivity between the state, federal and local government here, and we think that this is a great roadmap for where targeted investment could be made to make some real changes to the efficiencies across the grain supply chain there.
So when you look across states, for example, that sort of last mile issue for South Australia, is that sort of a little bit unique to this state because of the way that the network's set up for getting grain on and off farms and to collection points?
Absolutely. So grain freight movement in South Australia is a lot more concentrated than you might see, for example, compared to Victoria. So what we're really seeing there is that the flows are primarily directed towards some major export ports. And, you know, even the fact that five of the top six grain freight routes identified in the Grain Growers Report here, they're forming up part of that national land transport network. So, again, you know, needing this federal co-funding and maintaining and optimising infrastructure for South Australia is important, offset by the fact as well that you've got some local road access, significant variances there that are for local councils to take and pay attention to.
Yeah, and it's that the thing that makes it tricky to try and get funding, investment, planning sort of right across the board when you've got these different levels of government, when you're talking about federal roads, state roads, local government roads, there's so many players to try and get it all cohesive. That is the big challenge.
It is, absolutely. So, you know, Grain Growers Report here is highlighting that you've got national highways, you've got state-controlled roads, you've got local government routes, and rural infrastructure, as we know, can be tricky and complicated at best. So really, the purpose of this report is to go granular and to make sure that we've got some transit modelling done state by state in very specific areas for attention as well.
It can be tricky, but it also can be expensive. And it looks like from this report, there's also quite a bit of investment needed to upgrade some bridges here in South Australia that are on these key freight routes.
That's correct. So we've got some ageing bridges there where you're seeing bottlenecks that can slow things down. And fixing those issues, really, at the end of the day, it means that there's a more efficient transport hub and better returns for growers, which is really important. I think it's no surprise to anyone that these days farming is more expensive than it ever has been, where you've got rising input costs and labour and fuel, all those things that keep our farms ticking over. So if there's ways to actually make the supply chain and freight in particular more efficient, that means that our growers then, they're getting better productivity and better returns, which is really important.
Something that's been popping up in conversations a lot for us is the peri-urban sprawl and spreading of housing and new estates and homes that are popping up, and then where that is abutting up against traditional areas of agriculture. And one for the findings of South Australia is an example of perhaps some support planning in that area, where you've got things like roundabouts being built in new housing developments or new road developments that aren't fit for purpose for those large trucks to be making their way through.
Exactly. And, this is not just about cost savings and efficiency. It's also about safety there. When you're looking at those big trucks trying to traverse those areas, it is really important that some local planning, those routes are considered and what they're being used for.
What are you hoping this report will mainly achieve? Shoto obviously highlights, issues around planning and investment that need to be addressed.
If I could call on sort of all levels of government, the things to pay attention to or to take heed of in this report, the number one thing is obviously targeted upgrades to our regional roads. The second would be the ways we can mitigate the climate-related disruptions on our road networks here. And then the third one, and this applies to some parts of South Australia, but cross-border harmonisation is really critical as well. So I think the report, it is a first of its kind, which we're very excited about. We've taken a tool that the CSIRO has produced that actually maps out commodities moving across Australia and the complexities there. And we really feel that this is a great piece for decision makers to take forward about where we could really invest in or make changes to that would be deliver really good economic and logistical benefits on behalf of grain farmers in South Australia and across the nation.
Shona, thanks very much for joining us on the Country Hour. Thanks so much for your time.
Pleasure, Selena. Thanks for having me.
Shona Gabel there. She is from Grain Growers. She's their chief executive, and that's their new report, Australia's Priority Grain Freight Routes. You can read it on their website, and you can see the breakdown for some of the locations and key priorities that they listed for South Australia. You heard there they're talking about that sort of last mile between farm gate and the major freight routes, roundabouts and peri-urban areas, and some of the ageing bridge infrastructure. Is that, if you're a grower, is that what you would see as the key priorities along the freight route? Perhaps you've got some other areas where you think investment is desperately needed that's costing time and money. 1300 160222 is the talkback number. My text line again, 0467 922 783. It is 13 minutes past 12.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, the Bureau of Meteorology has issued an updated drought statement this week showing where rain did and didn't fall during October and how the drought situation is looking across the country. For South Australia, it seems things have eased in the past few months, but October was very much a mixed bag as far as rain went, and it was a very different story for the eastern and western parts of the state. Senior climatologist Jonathan Pollock ran through the data for us.
Yeah, there was a bit of contrast from west to east. Look, most of the western half of the state had above average October rainfall, and it was in the wettest 10% of October records for parts of the Southwest District and the Northwest Pastoral District. October rainfall was close to average for much of South Australia's agricultural areas, but it was drier than average for parts of the Flinders District. Maximum temperatures were warmer than average for most of South Australia during October, but were close to average for parts of the upper southeast and lower southeast districts, and minimum temperatures were warmer than average across the state.
Well, having a look at that rainfall map for October, and it is a sort of like this big blob of blue sort of on that far western border, as you say, then very much average for most of the state. And then you've still got this sort of red patch over towards the eastern border where it still was very dry. So depending on, you know, as you move across the state, very wet to unfortunately quite dry for the month.
Yeah, that's right, Selena. But for most of the agricultural area, October rainfall was close to average.
So now that we've accounted October in that, give us a bit of an update on what the drought situation or the rainfall deficiency is like for South Australia. We've been looking at this map for months and months and months on end now, and we've seen these sort of red patches of severe and serious deficiency expanding. Has that now started contracting?
Well, the year-to-date rainfall deficiencies improved slightly for parts of the agricultural areas following that sort of near-average October rainfall in those same parts. So there's less area in severe rainfall deficiency, that's in the driest 5% of climatology, compared to the January to September period. However, looking at a longer period, going back to February last year, there are still rainfall deficiencies across most of the agricultural areas, including areas of lowest on record rainfall, stretching from parts of the Eyre Peninsula, across the York Peninsula, Mid-North, Adelaide, Mount Lofty Ranges, all the way into Western Victoria.
Okay, so if you're looking at more of a shorter-term trend, it is those areas have been shrinking. It has eased a bit. But if you are looking at more of, as you say, that sort of longer-term pattern going back over a year or more, it is still a very much a visualisation of just how dry the last couple of years have been.
Yeah, there was more relief for that year-to-day rainfall deficiency for parts of Tasmania and Victoria compared to South Australia, but there was some reduction in that area with rainfall deficiency following that close-to-average October rainfall for parts of the agricultural area.
What's the rest of the year then look like? We've still got a little bit of spring to go, and then obviously we're into summer. What's the forecast then for the rest of the year?
So looking ahead, there is a bit of a wet signal for parts of the southern agricultural areas and the southwest for the second half of November. But there's no strong push towards above or below average rainfall across South Australia during December or January. Now, that's not a forecast for the average rainfall. For most parts, there is a fairly wide range of possible outcomes from very dry through to very wet. Maximum temperatures are likely to be above average for parts of the southeast and far north during December and for most of the state during January. Above average minimum temperatures are likely for most of South Australia during December and January.
That's senior climatologist Jonathan Pollock there speaking about the Bureau's most recent drought statement, which you can find on their website. With Selena Green, it is just going on 18 minutes past 12 here on the Country Hour. Well, there are calls for wider testing for potato mop top virus on the Australian mainland. Now, that's coming from Doug Clark, who works with Tasmania's potato seed certification scheme. And it all comes as the National Seed Certifier has been pushing to return all Tasmanian seed potatoes back to that state.
When we do a core test on a potato, that result either comes back as positive or not detected. It's never a negative test. So whilst that outcome it could have very low levels of mop top present within that line, or it may not have any of that virus present. So they're the two outcomes. It's never a negative test as such. So what we do know is that the lines that were moved to the mainland prior to the known outbreak of mop top in Tasmania, ready for the mainlanders to grow, is I believe that we've had two positive detections in two of those lines, like on those lines, but the other lines over there have had multiple tests conducted on them, and my understanding is that those tests have come back as not detected.
But it sounds like the Australian Seed Potato Industry Certification Authority isn't 100% confident in the testing. Are you suggesting that mainland farmers should just risk it and plant the Tassie seed anyway?
Look, it always comes back to either personal choice or requirements of biosecurity in each jurisdiction. So I don't want to talk around the biosecurity in each jurisdiction. That's up to them. I'm not going to go there. But what we do know, and through our testing in Tasmania, we have been able to give our Tasmanian growers great confidence around the presence of mop top in our seed potato lines. So that's a really good outcome. In way, are you better off to test and know what the status is versus not getting seed tested at all and taking the risk on planting that seed. So yesterday Auspicker touched on the actual testing itself and the core testing component. So we followed the Auspicker export requirements for that, and Nigel is totally correct, is that the virus could be on the external of the potato. But ultimately, we've tested to the best of our abilities, in the time frame we had. So that's all we can do and give Tasmanian growers in the first instance great surety around the presence of Moptop in those lines, which at the moment, mainland states do not have the ability or have not tested lines to, on a broader scale, to determine the status of Moptop within those lines.
So can seed potatoes that have come from Tasmania sent to Victoria be sent back here?
That's ultimately up to Biosecurity Tas to make that call. I would strongly suggest that those potatoes that have been delivered to the mainland would not meet import requirements back into Tasmania, the re-entry requirements. So ultimately that's up to Biosecurity Tas, and that's where I'd probably like to stop that comment.
it's clearly a sore point. So what does it mean for Tasmania if the industry can't export its potatoes to the mainland? Because it's clear that there's a little standoff going on here, that there is a meeting coming up on the 18th, but it sounds like a lot of the states are getting together and saying, we shouldn't accept these spuds from Tassie.
Look, there has been an open pathway from Tasmania to the mainland for decades for both movement of seed but also wet potatoes. So what, for me, one of the main outcomes I'd really like from next week is a really good understanding around the presence of Moptop on the mainland. So we know that accurately about Tasmania now because we undertook a really wide-reaching testing program. So at the moment, we as an industry, a whole Australian national potato industry, are really unsure if the distribution or possible distribution of Moptop on the mainland. So until we get a good picture on what that actually looks like, how can we then facilitate trade either between states or give growers the surety around what the presence of Moptop is within those lines? Because ultimately, we've got a bit of a hole in biosecurity somewhere. It's come into the country through a pathway. And at the moment, certainly Tasmanian growers, potato and Biosecurity Tas, cannot identify that pathway. So that is a huge concern to the Australian industry, because what else, wherever that entry point is, we need to the best of our ability, identify where that is at and close it as soon as we can.
And that's obviously done through wider testing. We've obviously exhausted that in Tassie, but not necessarily on the mainland.
Yeah, correct. So it comes back to that tracking and tracing. So one of the things we do know in Tasmania, we had multiple sites that the only plant material they bring in is early generation potatoes. That's a concern, is that we've got highly isolated sites. They do on their own planting, own cultivation on site. They don't bring any third-party machinery on. So that's the bit that concerns us at the moment. So, this is going to be one of the good things about the meeting next week, is hopefully after the small amount of testing that some private companies may have been doing, and maybe Auspicker themselves, I'm really hoping they're able to bring that data to the meeting and say, hey, look, this is the bit that we know, and that we possibly identify areas on a broader scale where, we could possibly do some testing on a national scale to actually build a area absence or presence of, so then seed can be grown within those areas with a high degree of surety that, they're going to be free from Moptop.
Doug Clark there from Tas Seed, and he was speaking with Larissa Smith. Well, before we get to the Weather Bureau, let's talk about yet another weed that we're being told to keep an extra eye out for because it is doing quite well at the moment. This one features lilac flowers, silver green leaves, small yellow prickles and berry-like fruit, silverleaf nightshade, and it spreads quickly and is highly toxic. The invasive weed can also threaten crop yields as it spreads very quickly and is hard to kill. Murraylands and Riverland Landscape Board District Officer Brent Miller says it's started germinating across that region as the weather warms up.
The new germinations are coming through now. So the plants that haven't been controlled that were there last year that have the berries on, each of those berries can produce 75 odd seeds, and any plant can have up to 30 or 40 berries on it. So those seeds that have dropped to the ground with a little bit of rain that we've had around recently are now germinating. And as you can appreciate, that totals about up to 2,000 plants per single plant as far as seed drop goes.
It's pretty prolific. It's like a rabbit of plants.
It is, yes.
And so at the moment, is that pretty widespread across the region? Where are you seeing it?
It's popping up all over the place. We have some focus areas that we look at. All of our district offices are monitoring for silverleaf nightshade, as they are all of our different types of declared species of weeds. So roadsides are particularly prominent at the moment. It does tend to come up out in the wheat crops in amongst after the harvest of wheat, so that it can get a little bit more sunlight. But you'll see it popping up in vineyards almost anywhere at the moment.
And what sort of effects can it have on the environment and I guess also on agriculture?
So number one, it's invasive, so it's not a native. So it hails from both North and South America, and it can be highly invasive, so it can inundate an area with several plants in a fairly short space of time. The nasty thing about this weed is that it's actually highly toxic to humans and livestock, as well as domestic pets. So if they ingest the berries, it can be quite dangerous for them.
So it would be a trip to the vet or to the hospital?
100%, yes. Off to the vet. And just see what they can do. But it's certainly not advised that it's ingested, that's for sure.
Yeah, and what sort of controls are there and ways of reducing and minimising the spread and prevalence of this weed?
So that's why we're out at this time of the year. We're out there monitoring for new incursions or for re-incursions of silverleaf nightshade. Some of the heavier infested areas we do monitor. We do a spray program around this time of year so that as soon as the plant pops through and germinates, we're trying to get out there and spray it as early as we can before it goes to seed. If you've got it on your vineyard or on any sort of property that you own, it's advised that as soon as you see it pop through the ground, do a little bit of research on it, know exactly what it looks like, try and get it before it goes to flower and then goes to seed.
As Murraylands and Riverland Landscape Board District Officer Brenton Miller there speaking with Eliza Burlage. If you'd like to get some support with your spray regime, you can contact the board on 8580 1800. It's just going on 28 minutes past 12. You're with Selena Green, but we've got to head to the Weather Bureau now. Hannah Marsh is our forecaster again today. Hi, Hannah.
Hi, Selena.
Has much changed since we checked in yesterday?
Well, we did have that weak cold front clip the southeast overnight. We saw totals of 2 to 8 millimetres about the southern agricultural area, with less than 3 millimetres elsewhere, with the highest being 8 millimetres at Parowa and Mount Gambier. Since 9 a.m, oh, I should have mentioned that cold front did move out over Victoria by sunrise this morning. We just left in a southwesterly airstream with some shower activity about southern coasts. And since 9 a.m, we have seen falls of less than 1 millimetre about the coast and the lower southeast, with the highest being 1 millimetre at Mount Gambier. We've got a high pressure system that's south of the Bight, and that's clearing the cloud as we head into the afternoon period as well. So having a look at some of the maximum temperatures that it's been up to so far today, we've been as cool as 11 degrees at Mount Lofty and 12 at Parowa, grading all the way up to 28 degrees at Oodnadatta and 29 at Moomba. As we head into tomorrow, that high pressure system dominates. We will see clear skies leading to cold overnight temperatures, with the possibility of seeing some early morning frost about inland agricultural areas. There could still be a few showers lingering about the lower southeast coast also, but they will clear during the morning. We've got a trough that we're expecting to push into the west later tomorrow. And associated with that, we will see some showers and thunderstorms starting to develop about the far northwest corner of the state. There is the possibility of seeing some heavy rainfall and damaging wind gusts in the far northwest corner of the state with those thunderstorms tomorrow. Having a look at some of the temperatures for tomorrow, we're getting up to 29 degrees at Ceduna, 24 for Port Lincoln, 27 at Whyalla, Cooper Pedy 31, Roxby Downs 30, Oodnadatta 33, 27 at Renmark, 26 at Murray Bridge, 25 for Clare, 23 at Mount Barker and Victor Harbour, 22 at Kingscote and 18 degrees at Mount Gambier. Then as we head towards Thursday, that trough brings that shower and thunderstorm activity further eastwards, really extending throughout the state as we head towards Friday, and then we start seeing that clearing out as we get another high pressure system move through. Again, there is the possibility of seeing some severe thunderstorms through the northwest parts of the state. And then as we head into Friday, we will see that thunderstorm activity focus around the southern agricultural area during the day. In terms of cumulative rainfall totals up until the end of Saturday, we're generally looking at less than 5 millimetres. This will increase to 2 to 10 millimetres about the agricultural area and western districts, with 5 to 15 millimetres about windward coasts and ranges, Eyre Peninsula and parts of the northwest pastoral district, and further increasing to 15 to 30 millimetres about the far northwest. Also associated with thunderstorms, there is the possibility of seeing 10 to 30 millimetres with the thunderstorms, but then through that far northwest corner, we could see falls of 20 to 50 millimetres with thunderstorms.
Thanks, Hannah. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you.
Hannah Marsh there, our forecaster today. At the Weather Bureau, looking at the western inland parts of New South Wales for Wednesday, sunny in the upper western district with south to southeasterly winds, 15 to 20 k's now, turning east to southeasterlies, 15 to 25 k's now in the morning before becoming light in the late afternoon. Overnight falling between 8 and 13 degrees, daytime temperatures reaching the high 20s. For the lower western district, also sunny, there is a chance of frost in the far east in the early morning. Light winds throughout the day, overnight temperatures between 4 and 8 degrees. During the day, they should reach the mid to high 20s. It is 28 minutes to 1.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Coming up, some good news with another South Australian region declared fruit fly free. So some good news to celebrate there. And speaking of celebration, we'll check in with a South Australian winery that's just won a global award for its cellar door offering pairing wine with food. That's all to come after we get some news headlines from Matt Coleman. Good afternoon, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, hundreds have gathered at the Australian War Memorial in Canberra to mark the 107th anniversary of the armistice that ended World War I. Dignitaries, including the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and the opposition leader Susan Lee, were among those who laid wreaths. The state government says Ceduna on the west coast has been declared free of Mediterranean fruit fly. The Department for Primary Industries says restrictions have now been lifted as the fly has not been detected in Ceduna since April. And the federal government says climate activists around the world want to see the hosting rights standoff between Australia and Turkey resolved for next year's COP climate summit. The Assistant Minister for Climate Change and Energy, Josh Wilson, is at COP30 in Brazil, with the COP31 host to be decided before the event ends next Friday. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Coleman with those headlines. Talking about Silverleaf Nightshade before and the calls to have a look out for that in the Riverland text that's come through. This one says there are gazanias everywhere, which are a massive problem, and they're worried about Silverleaf Nightshade, which our text says, which is not a problem. I don't know if you were listening in last week, but Jess Schremer did an excellent story about the gazania issue, particularly in the Riverland and Mallee, though it is a big problem in much of the country. Hop on the website abc.net.au/rural and she touches on just how big of an issue it is in that district, to some of the work going on to try and come up with some controls and ways to get rid of it, but it is very pervasive, and some of those ongoing calls for greater controls over the sale Invasive Species Council and others calling for a banning of the sale of gazanias for people to actually buy and plant them. When you think about the fact that you can buy a noxious weed in a nursery and plant it, and then off it goes and causes such damage, is just bonkers, I think, is the way it was described, and you have to agree. Well, yes, as you heard in those headlines there, as of today, Ceduna can call itself free of Mediterranean fruit fly. The medfly outbreak in Ceduna was first detected back in late February this year through traps that are routinely monitored. As a result of the eradication program, no further detections have occurred in that area since April. The Minister for Primaries Industries, Claire Scriven, says it's a good outcome for locals and for the whole West Coast.
Now there is the opportunity declaring today that it is free from Mediterranean fruit fly, which is a really great outcome. And I think it really does show, you know, when we've got that combination of residents being willing to be really cooperative with, the inspections and the baiting and those sorts of things, as well as having that real intensive effort. We've had sterile medflies released over a 12-week period. There'll still be a couple more weeks of that. All of those things put together really means that it is possible to get on top of these things, which I think is really encouraging.
You mentioned there that the public were very accepting of the work that had to be done. Tell us about what had to be done there at Ceduna.
Yeah, so in addition to people not being able to, you know, share vegetables and fruits that are subject to fruit fly outside of an area, if they were in one of the red or yellow areas, it also enabled people to actually have PRRSA staff go into their gardens. There was baiting, there was the other aspects in terms of the eradication. It's not something that everyone really wants to happen. None of us really want people coming into our gardens, but because they were willing to cooperate with that, that has resulted in this positive outcome.
That sterile insect technique that you spoke about, how important has that been to the state and dealing with fruit fly?
Well, I think it's a real game changer. So we've had roughly 1 million a week being released in the Ceduna area, and that's the sterile medfly. And we've been having something like 40 million released in other parts of the state for Q fly or Queensland fruit fly. And so that's making a real difference, because what it means is mating still happens, but there are no offspring. So that breaks up the breeding cycle. And that's a really incredibly important part because, of course, the baiting and the trapping has been happening, but to also be able to break that breeding cycle is a really important part of this.
Obviously, this was Mediterranean fruit fly, but what does this mean for the rest of the state that this has been such a successful program in Ceduna?
Well, I think the fact that we've been able to eradicate it in Ceduna, and also just in the last couple of weeks, we were also able to announce the eradication of Q fly in Swan Reach in the Riverland. So one of the Riverland areas was able to be released as well. I think it really does show that there is hope when people work together, when there is that cooperation, as well as that science-based effort that's really intensive, that we can get on top of these outbreaks. We consider South Australia to be kind of the buffer in the middle of the country. So medfly is established in Western Australia, but we stop it coming into South Australia and therefore into the eastern states. And similarly with Q fly, which is established in the eastern states, we try to be that buffer between the eastern states and Western Australia, as well as, of course, protecting our own horticulture, produce, and all of the industries that rely on horticulture, citrus, etc.
What happens now that Ceduna has been declared as fruit fly free? Does monitoring continue to take place? Are traps still kept out there around the West Coast?
Yes, that's right. So there's some permanent monitoring traps in Ceduna and the surrounding areas, and that's really part of the early warning network. So those traps are checked regularly to make sure that the area will remain free from fruit fly, and also any quick response if there are any future detections. And the other thing is people will continue to see the fruit fly for a while, because we'll have those sterile male medflies being released in Ceduna. So that will happen until I think it's about mid-December. That was part of that 12-week release. So people may still see it. And we still encourage people, of course, to report anything they think is suspicious if they find it in their fruit. But the medflies will continue to be released until mid-December. And that should be that final assurance phase in terms of confirming the eradication.
That's the Minister for Primary Industries and Regional Development, Claire Scriven, speaking with Brooke Neindorf. While the Ceduna outbreak has now ended and Swan Reach, which we mentioned last week, quarantine restrictions remain in place for Queensland fruit fly outbreaks in Salisbury North, Glynde and numerous sites in the Riverland as that eradication program continues. All of those details for when those outbreaks end and what is and isn't restricted are all on PERS's website. If you do suspect fruit fly, you can call the fruit fly hotline on 1300 666 010 or visit fruitfly.sa.gov.au. You're with Selena Green on this Tuesday. Well, Australian farmers will be watching closely as the government of the biggest buyer of Australian beef says it will investigate what it's calling collusion in the meat industry. US President Donald Trump has called for the investigation. He says beef processors are driving up prices through, I quote him, illicit collusion, price fixing and price manipulation that is, again quoting the US President, jeopardising the nation's food supply. Here is how the American media is reporting the news.
President Trump ordering a DOJ investigation into foreign meat packers, accusing them of inflating U.S. beef prices.
President Trump accusing four of the biggest meat packing companies of driving up U.S. beef prices, which hit record highs in August.
Yeah. Really expensive right now right. at the grocery store. The president now looking into it. You could say he has beef with this particular nice. Industry here by looking into what he's calling illicit collusion, price fixing and price manipulation against companies that pack America's meat.
Beef is a big part of the freedom in this country, and I always say where there is beef, there is freedom, and that's what I believe.
I agree.
Well, analysts question whether America's expensive beef is at the fault of the meat packers. Warwick Long spoke with Simon Quilty from Global AgriTrends, and he says he doesn't agree with President Trump.
Really, Warwick, I don't believe that's the case, because reality is that meat processing companies in America have been losing near on $270 per animal since February this year. So if it's collusion, then it's collusion on how to lose money, which doesn't make sense. So no, to me, it's reaching out, looking to blame someone for effectively what a very high retail prices. So what it's a pretty simple equation, Warwick. If you look at the value of beef and in terms of cattle and the price rise that we've seen over the last year, which is 22% to 32%, depending on the month, and you look at what we've seen in terms of retail and wholesale prices, retail's only up 8.3% in that same period. Wholesale's up, probably closer to 17%. So the sums don't add up. There's simply not enough cattle in the system.
President Trump was elected on the basis of, well, partly because grocery prices were going up, and he said he could lower them. Meat prices have continued to go up, so he's looking for someone to blame. He says it's the meat packing companies, but you're saying the data doesn't support that.
No, I mean, the July figures came out on their herd inventory. They started collecting those in the mid-70s, and it's the lowest ever since the mid-70s, came in at 94.2 million. So, Warwick, it's just fundamentals. They've depleted their herd for the last, 3 to 4 years due to very severe drought. So this is just a demand and supply problem.
Let's have a look then at the state of the US meat industry at the moment. Four large companies dominate 85% of beef processing in America. That's part of what the president wants to look at there. But you say all four are currently losing money.
They are, and this isn't the first year this is the case. So let's look at the largest, which is Tyson Foods, Warwick. And last year, in 2024, they lost the equivalent of $587 million Australian. And the year before, they lost $140 million Australian. And this year, they're predicted to lose probably in excess of $600 million Australian. So, what's very clear is that when you simply do not have the supply and you're trying to maintain workers, plus high input costs, Warwick, the sums simply don't add up at the moment for a US beef processor.
So there's four major players. So Tyson's a big one there. Who else is there? Are they American-owned like Tyson, or are they international companies?
No, you've got basically Cargill and Tyson's are the two US companies, and then you've got JBS and National Foods, which are effectively Brazilian-owned. So you've got South America, North America ownership dominating the market. And trust me, if they could make a dollar, they would be. There is no collusion given these enormous losses.
And JBS and Cargill are the two biggest beef processors in Australia as well, two of those four companies, which brings me to really the point I had in contacting you today, Simon Quilty, and that is, if this investigation's going on in the United States, what could happen from it, and what could it mean for Australian meat companies and farmers who are currently supplying that market in a big way?
Look, I think it not a great deal. I think that the fundamentals don't change. I think Australia will move into a rebuild itself next year. We've got Brazil about to move into a rebuild. The USDA released figures only last week, Warwick, talking of a 400,000-ton shortage globally of beef next year. So this problem is to be potentially repeated in other countries as supply gets tighter and tighter and rebuilds occur across three of the major suppliers. So do I see any fundamental changes? No. I see real challenges. But fortunately, each of these processors have deep pockets. They've been here before. They know that this is part of the cattle cycle globally. And Warwick, I just see actually very good pricing for cattle producers across those three countries for the next 2 to 3 years.
So that's interesting, looking at the market conditions with the United States president, who rightly or wrongly has been seen as quite unpredictable for markets. You think with those conditions, Australian farmers are largely insulated from what may be decided across the shores in what has been our biggest market of late?
I think so. And part of that is not just pricing within North America, but the needs of all the other markets, whether it's Japan, Korea, China. They are all reliant upon, you know, Australia, America, and Brazil for supply. And when all three countries are tight, there's only one thing that happens. Prices globally will move higher here.
And last time the president said he wanted to do something about beef prices, you rightly predicted he was going to look towards Argentina. He says he's going to let in more Argentinian beef. Are there things you're watching now as a result of this? Are there more levers you expect the US administration to pull?
I think there is, Warwick. The obvious one is Brazil and dropping the 50% quota or tariff, I should say, going in, that would then make that lean beef for their need for hamburgers much more cost effective. That's from an Australian point of view, one to watch. I really think they're running out of options, though, in terms of finding ways and means and mechanisms to lower prices. Simply, there is too much demand and not enough supply.
Simon Quilty from Global AgriTrends sharing his thoughts there with Warwick Long. And that takes us to 12 minutes to one.
Gallipoli. When it comes to understanding war, art is our secret weapon.
Rachel Griffiths presents When the War is Over.
If it's too risky to say, sing it.
Starts Tuesday, November 18 on ABC TV and ABC iView.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Let's head to McLaren Vale, where the family-owned Maxwell Wines has been recognised as a winner at the 2026 Global Best of Wine Tourism Awards, which are held in Bordeaux in France. The winery was praised by the judges for raising the bar for culinary experiences here in South Australia. Mark Maxwell from Maxwell Wines joins me. Afternoon, Mark, and welcome to the Country Hour.
Hello, welcome to be here.
And congratulations. This is an international award, a global award, recognising the work that you're doing there at the winery. What does it mean to you and to everyone involved there to be recognised, in this global way?
Oh, it's fantastic. It's a great credit to the team. We're all putting time in to really make as good an offering as we can. This entity, the Great Wine Capitals Group, pick out the best of all the regions in the world, which is Napa Valley and Bordeaux and Mendoza, and they just go around judging the various offerings that people have, and we were fortunate enough to win the Australian award, which was the Great Wine Capitals of Adelaide. And then they've secretly sent judges out, and we ended up in winning in Bordeaux for the area of providing an experience for great wines and food matching. So it's separate to the restaurant.
So tell us a bit about the experience that you do provide there at the winery and how long you've been doing it.
We have been running the sort of great food in the restaurant for a number of years. So this new expansion, we'll be taking the talents of the chefs to create snacks that are like little tidbits, little sort of bite-sized pieces of some of the food that comes out of the restaurant. And people can have that while they're having a wine tasting in the winery.
Beautiful. Is this a sort of an integral part now of what you do there, of offering something that little bit different or something special for people who come to the winery?
I think there's an evolution. I think a lot of wineries now are looking to realise that they can serve some sort of food while with the tastings. It just becomes responsible service of alcohol and becomes a pleasure. So our approach to it is to be right at the top as best we can of the food quality.
I imagine you get a lot of people from the area and the greater Adelaide area coming in and having an experience there, but are you getting people far and wide and now maybe even further and wider now that you know, you've got this award?
Well, that's the hope, that will spread the word further. But, yes, certainly lots of people from Adelaide and interstate come to dine here. Now, the new-ish direction here where you can come and have a tasting and try some of the food that our chefs create is quite special. It's really very, very good-looking, beautiful presented food, and then tastes delicious as well.
Obviously, it's a tough industry to be in at the moment. There's a lot of wine out there and a lot of wine experiences. How important is it to do something like this to stand out, I guess, and have something else to offer your consumers?
You're quite right. It is getting harder with the sort of potential decrease in the amount of total wine being drunk. We're looking for sort of different ways to sort of keep ourselves relevant. One of them is that we're very conscious of dealing with people in our wine club, and that's been really successful. That's been terrific. Our people really enjoy being part of a sort of our big family, so we can offer them deals and offer them little things that other people can't get. And so part of the looking after people has become critical.
This is all about drawing people into the winery and having an experience and hopefully taking some wine home with them. Are you also sending your wines out into the world, and where's that going at the moment?
It's all good. It's not as strong as pre-COVID, but the same customers, the importers that we've had in various countries are still dealing with us. We've got some increasing business happening in America at the moment. Malaysia, China's steady. It comes and goes. It's not as perhaps as large as it was. But then the Nordic countries still seem to be very happy to keep drinking wine. So Sweden and Norway are terrific people.
Fantastic. I hope they continue for sure. And has the season, has the year been kind to you there in McLaren Vale for growing?
Yes, it has. Yeah, the 25 seasons that is now is just looking fabulous. The grapes are forming on the vine. The leaves are really beautiful coloured green. So, and there's a reasonable crop. So all is looking pretty smart. We've got, I hope, a bit more warmer weather. Although this weather's lovely for enjoying it and the vines are being very healthy, a bit of sunshine would be good too.
Absolutely. Well, Mark, congratulations again. It's a fantastic honour, especially to be recognised alongside such illustrious company, as you say, those other wine capitals. It's a very exclusive club, so very nice to get the nod from an organisation like that. Congratulations and thanks so much for joining us on the Country Hour.
Thanks, Selena. That's great.
Mark Maxwell there from Maxwell Wines, winner at the Global Best of Wine Tourism Awards, which was presented at the Great Wine Capitals Gala Dinner in France. If you're listening in yesterday, I spoke with Jo Collins, also from South Australia. Jo works with Perza, and she's also just been elected president of this Global Great Wine Capitals Network. It is 7 minutes away from one. Well, finally, today, as we get a bit closer to summer, you might be holding out for some of your favourite stone fruits, and maybe you get your fix from Taralee Orchard in the Wabara Forest. Renee Kirchmer runs the biodynamic orchard with her father and her brother, and she says their Christmas plans usually involve apricot picking.
So far, it's shaping up to be a pretty good fruit set. The rain's obviously helped out immensely. We haven't had to irrigate, whereas like last year, it was probably start of September, we had to get the irrigation going, and that was a lot of work. It is a lot of work irrigating the orchard. Any rain for us is, really helpful.
So are you picky about when it comes? Like, was it a bit too late or was the rain perfect timing?
It's been pretty good. We didn't have too much wet weather during September when the trees were blossoming, so I didn't get too many problems with sort of like blossom rot or anything like that. No, it's been good. And the last month we've had, another couple inches. Oh, the trees just love it. You can just see how much brighter green they are.
So what's the fruit looking like compared to last year? Are you going to get more numbers or just better quality, or how's it going to compare?
Yeah, the last 2 years, it's been such a dry period up here. They've, really not put much energy into fruit production. So we were a bit sceptical coming into this season, thinking that they'd come out of such a dry time, they wouldn't have such a good fruit set. But no, the trees have done really well, especially the peaches and plums. They've actually set very heavy. So for the peaches and nectarines, we've had to go off thinning most of the trees. So that's where you take off every second fruit, just so that the ones that are left get to grow out. Otherwise, they'll probably all grow sort of golf ball size fruit. So that's a thing that you can manage, where if they don't set in the first place, you can't do much about that.
When are you thinking you're going to start harvesting the fruit?
Yeah, it'll probably be, I'd say, start of December. Or if we're lucky and get a few cherries, that'll be late November. And we have got a few early varieties of apricots. So, again, late November, they might start colouring up a bit. Already on the trees, they're pretty good size. So, still a month left of growing. I think, apricots will do pretty well this year.
So how long does the harvest take? Like picking everything you've got, how long does it take?
Yeah, we've got a lot of different varieties. That's sort of how we run, a fair bit of diversity here. So, right from the first varieties we've got of cherry trees, that's, late November, right through until sort of Easter time is the cutoff. So, we've got peaches, plums, nectarines coming through, different varieties right from different months of summer. And then later in sort of March, April even, we've got apples, pears and quinces that come through. Soon it'll start and then it'll be a long few months of, keeping the birds out.
No break for Christmas then?
No, it's usually that is exactly when we've had our main crop of Travat apricots ripening. Usually those last 2 weeks of December. So, Christmas is generally picking apricots.
There's been a few less bees around in some parts of the state with the drought. Did you have any issues when it came to pollination or anything?
Well, we've got a few beehives ourselves here. We don't, specifically rely on, like, the European honeybee for the pollination. We've got a lot of native wasps and other small insects, which, have built up in the orchard because we've got a lot of native trees planted along the windrows, shelter breaks. So, we think that just the native insects have actually kept up with the pollination this year, and that the declining honeybees may not impact us as we initially feared it would.
Has there been any main issues this year other than lack of rain, or has it been a pretty steady season?
No, it's pretty good. With like rainfall on fruit trees this time of year, probably anyone that has like peach or nectarine trees at home would notice that they've got curl leaf. And that's something which, we do have a fair bit of that. But if you get a bit of airflow, a bit of sunny weather, usually that clears up and the tree can actually just grow new shoots with fresh, younger leaves. And that doesn't actually impact the overall health of the tree. So some years we've had to put a copper oxide spray out, but we tend to, try to stay away from that. Biodynamic orchard and any sort of chemical sprays and things, really try to stay right away from them. We have a lot of understory, like ground cover around the fruit trees, just the whole orchard, really. We try to keep ground cover year round. And the rain has just really, allowed that to take off. Doesn't mean a lot more work on a brush cutter and a mower. But for us, it's a good thing because the orchard sort of relies on the pastures to be mulched down, and that's what provides the fertility for the fruit trees, because we don't actually put out any fertilizers or chemical additives.
If we keep getting a lot of rain in the next couple of weeks, is that a problem for you or no?
It wouldn't be too much of an issue. If the cherries are ripe, then they will split, and same with the apricots. Mm. But that's really only pretty well of the day or day before like ripening time. So even if they're just a little bit green, they generally won't be impacted. And just the overall health of the trees and the rest of the orchard, that just far outweighs the loss that we would have from splitting fruit.
Renee Kirchmer there from Taralee Orchards, and she was speaking with Isabella Kelly. That's it for me for today. Selena Green bringing you the Country Hour, and I'll be back tomorrow at noon to bring it to you all over again. Don't forget, in the meantime, you can find all of our episodes on our website, which is abc.net.au. Well, if you search for South Australian Country Hour, that's the easiest way to find us, or hop on the ABC Listen app, and you can find us and lots of other great ABC audio content on there as well. To find all our online articles, it's abc.net.au/rural. Have a great rest of your afternoon. Catch you tomorrow. It's coming up to 1 o'clock and it's time for the news.
For many, the cost of living and financial hardship is taking its toll. ABC Radio is supporting disadvantaged and vulnerable people across Australia with ABC Gives. Donate now at abc.net.au/gives.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.